So we're going to discuss sizes, and it's kind of freeform. So there are many issues that are interesting, I think, in sizes. There's also a topic that spans both scalar sizes, sizes of cell distribution, and gas sizes. And we plan to touch on gas sizes as well as stars, but mostly we're going to talk about the sizes of scalar distribution. But in the end, we'll come back to gas, and also that's something to keep in mind that those things are not necessarily the same. The size, I think, is why, I mean, for people who don't think about sizes, why do you should care? Size is a property of galaxy that's very different from the actual overall stellar mass, and it opens a significant additional dimension into both probing galaxy formation and also exploring galaxy halo connection. And size definitely plays a huge role, because if you think about fundamental plane, one of the tightest correlations that we know exhibited by galaxies is that they live on a manifold that people call in three-dimensional space. And the size plays an important role in finding the quantities that control the manifold. So that's something that is definitely important, but is receiving less attention than the relationship between the overall mass of the galaxy, baryon mass, and the halo mass. So we definitely hope to explore this more during the workshop, how sizes connect to the properties of the halo. But there's a lot of interesting issues that relate to both the definition of sizes and also the correlations with galaxy properties. So that's where we hope to start this discussion today, but it probably won't end during the discussion today. So we decided that Mike will start off by introducing some of the issues that are important, and then we'll continue to take it from there.
Okay, thanks. And so let me just apologize right now for the PowerPoint. I don't like doing it in this sort of informal setting. However, I like even less plotting data on a chalkboard and trying to get the error bars right and all that sort of thing. So the way I want to introduce the topic, and we'll see if this is going to work or not, but I thought a way into this would be to show the results of a data set on various relations between the properties of galaxies and the sizes in particular, and how they connect to other properties. And that'll take us into some issues of definitions and comparing results in different surveys and so on and so forth. But what we'd really like to talk about is, I think we'll come in the second half of this hour, which is the theory for what determines the sizes of galaxies. What's the physics that determines the size of the galaxies? But we thought that it would make sense to start the discussion by appealing to some, and I know this is dangerous in a theoretical institute like this, but to appealing to some data to sort of ground the discussion in what it is we're actually trying to explain. So I'm going to try to go through quickly, very quickly, some of the observational results, the definitions, and the various interconnections between the properties of galaxies. And I'm doing this PowerPoint just because that's a lot easier than plotting individual dots and trying to get them right reflected. So the results I'm going to show you come out of a study that Aaron Romanofsky and I have been doing now for a number of years, about 5 years, particularly focused on the angular momentum of galaxies. The angular momentum of galaxies is one of the key properties for the galaxies, and it's very much determined by, you know, the product of how big they are times how fast they rotate. So the sizes come into the angular momentum of galaxies, the sizes come into the energy, and therefore how much energy they radiate away in their formation, so on and so forth. It plays a lot of important roles in galaxy formation. What Aaron and I have been doing is studying very carefully a sample of about 100 galaxies. So it's a relatively small sample by the standards of the Sloan survey and some of these other big surveys. But these are nearby galaxies. They're mostly NGC galaxies. They're very well studied. They're very well measured. So there really isn't much debate on what the measurements are saying about these galaxies. There's a question about what happens at the very high mass end, which we don't sample very well, or the very low mass end, which we don't sample very well because we only have 100 galaxies, or perhaps even the low surface brightness end. But when we're talking about galaxies within about a factor of 10 in mass of M star, this is a good sample to start with, because we can be pretty sure that the observations are as under control as we can get in this subject. When we go to high redshifts or the Sloan survey, big samples like that, more distant galaxies, then other issues come in, like how accurately we can actually measure things. That won't affect, I hope, what I'm saying here. All right, let me just see here. So, okay, so let me start with some, we have various measurements of these galaxies, including the internal kinematics of the galaxies, the velocity rotation curve, the dispersion profile. We have the surface brightness profiles in projection and QD and so on and so forth. So we can decompose the galaxies into their spheroidal components, their bulges and their disks separately. You might think that would be more complicated than actually starting out with the galaxies whole. But we'll see in this subject that it's actually better to build the galaxies up from their two parts. So what's shown here is...
Could I just ask about the sample? Is this a volume-limited sample? Is it it's complete, right?
And it's not complete, no. Okay. It's a well-studied survey. However, we have plotted up all the quantities we can measure, like surface brightnesses and sizes and luminosities, on the plots of surveys that are much more complete, and we don't see any significant differences or biases. So we believe that this is representative. We believe it's unbiased, but it's not strictly volume limited or magnitude limited. It was chosen because we needed galaxies that had kinematics up to very large radii to measure the angular momentum. So that's what we're talking about. Okay, so this is now getting down to the sizes. This is the size measured in projection along the major axis, the 2D half-light radius versus the stellar mass. And I'm plotting everything against stellar mass in these diagrams. That's a derived quantity. It's an M1L times the luminosity in the K-band, and then a mass-to-light ratio, which depends weakly on color. So the mass-to-light ratio won't be the same for the spheroids and the disks, and that's taken into account here as best we can. But that introduces another element of uncertainty in this direction here that we have to live with if we want to plot things as a function of mass. So here are the sizes now seen in projection along the major axis, nothing corrected for anything, basically. And what you see here are the elliptical galaxies, just as they come, and we're taking these as the exemplars of pure spheroids, pure bulges. And then the blue dots here are the disks of the galaxies that have disks, with the bulge or the spheroid taken out and thrown away and not plotted on this diagram. So this is deliberately to compare essentially pure spheroids with pure disks. No composite structures in this diagram at all. We really just, we're asking the question, in this diagram, what is the slope of this sort of relation and is there an offset? And what you can see is that there is an offset. It's a factor of 2 or 3 or so just when the data are plotted in this way here. And this shows up most clearly, again, when we divide the spheroids from the disks.
The way you tell this is an elliptical or a disk, by looking at the surface index?
No, these galaxies are close enough that they, all the experts, the Bokalur and Sandage have made pronouncements about these galaxies. So, mere mortals like us never had to face a decision like that. okay, now we come to the question of how are we going to measure the size of galaxies. As I said, this is the sort of raw measurement here. But that's not necessarily the most interesting size. And the issue of how you define the sizes of galaxies, and especially if you want to compare one sample with another, you have to be careful that you're using the same definition of sizes. And, you know, just the size of the galaxy along the long axis projected on the sky is necessarily the most physically revealing size of the galaxy. On the other hand, we're faced with the question of how you make a comparison between an intrinsically flat object and an intrinsically round object. And there is inevitably going to be some subjectivity in that. If I give you an orange, say, and a sheet of paper, and I ask you which is bigger, I think your answer should be, change the question, give me a different question. Give me a better question. You know, and so there will be inevitably some subjectivity, but we should pick definitions that we can agree are at least sensible, and especially if we want to compare the results of one survey to another, we should be using the same convention. And so what's plotted here is the same galaxies, but where the sizes are calculated a little bit differently, and this is basically coming from Andre's recommendations. Now we've sort of followed his rules entirely in doing this. And so this is meant to be the 3D half-light radius. Ideally, you'd like to have the 3D half-mass radius. So we're not, in this study, trying to take into account mass-to-light ratio radial variations in galaxies. So we're still talking about where half the light is versus the stellar mass. Ideally, it would be half-mass radii in 3D. And what's done here is for the elliptical galaxies to circularize the radius, that is to take essentially the geometric mean of the long and the short axes as the sort of average radius, and then multiply that by 4/3, which is the relationship between the half-mass radius in 3D and the half-mass radius in 2D. And that's true of almost any object. By the way, all the sizes that I'm going to be talking about, and all the sizes I think anybody should talk about in this field, are all closely related to half-light and half-mass radii. If you start talking about the outer parts of galaxies or photometric radii or something like that, it's not clear physically that that's even interesting, right? If you have a galaxy and it just fades, then the photometric radii are going to get smaller without moving a single atom around in the galaxy. So you want to stay away from photometric. You need to stick to something that measures an actual size that takes account of the structure of the galaxy. And the half-mass radius is a good one. The half-light radius is another good one. They're related to each other by a factor of order unity. They're also very useful because they're the ones that typically come into most of the calculations of the energy and the angular momentum of the galaxies.
They do depend on the photometry still, though, right?
They do, and they do also depend on the assumption that the mass-to-light ratio is not a function of radius.
What example did you see here exactly? So you said that the
galaxies are fitted to a de Vaucouleurs plus an exponential profile, and then the exponential, the de Vaucouleurs part of the thing is thrown away and got rid of. The disk that remains is the gradient there measures essentially the disk exponential scaling, and 1.68 times that is the Sartorius. Looking down on the floor, pull it down. When you account for the inclination, you can calculate the exponential scale length of the galaxy, and then half the mass is contained in a. If you look at it pulled down, half the mass is contained in a cylinder that's 1.68 times that exponential scale length. And then for these galaxies, it's 4/3 times the circularized radius. But the difference, the point I want to make here is that any of these conventions that we pick will differ from each other by factors of a few tens of percent. But the difference in sizes is significantly bigger than that. So it's this offset that we see in this diagram here is not a product of exactly, specifically what definition you pick. There's still a substantial, any reasonable definition, at least any of the ones that I've seen, will give you this factor of 2 or 3 offset here. So why are we interested in the size? Well, for their own, you know, one of the things we're interested in is the size of galaxies for their own intrinsic interest. I mean, I can give you a couple more reasons. Just imagine the size of all galaxies were increased by a factor of 10, then you basically, in these deep fields, galaxies would overlap with the covering factor of galaxies would be large, and you wouldn't be able to actually see individual galaxies, for example.
Is the reason why you seem to be disagreeing with what Andre said is because that you've taken pure disks and pure...
Yeah, I'll come to that. Yeah. In fact, let me say it right now. Let me say it right now since you've raised the thing. This is why I wanted to present in this form to you, because for many of the samples, it's harder to get these quantities. And so what's plotted is typically the half-life radius of a whole galaxy. And I think what you can see here is that if you were to build a galaxy by taking something along this relation and something along this relation, then the composite galaxy would lie in between. That's obvious. And so if you have a sample of galaxies that has a wide range of disk to bulge ratios, you know, it will essentially move down this way, and this will move up that way. So if you were to add disks onto these, or add spheroids onto these, it would bring them, you know, closer together. And so I think that's the heart of some of the, I won't call it disagreement, but I think because I don't think there is any disagreement anymore. But I think that this is why I wanted to present this with a sample where you can really study the galaxies up close.
But I don't think you can call the disk size the size of the galaxy. It's the size of the component.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an important decision.
I completely agree. I'm emphasizing pure spheroids, pure disk.
So those galaxies were galaxies without disks. Without spheroids. The things you're plotting as disks are things basically which...
Yeah, you take out the spheroid and throw it away. Yeah. So it's the size of the disk component of the galaxy.
And many of these galaxies have very little many of these disk galaxies have very small spheroids.
But you're taking the spheroid out.
The spheroid is gone. It's been taken out. Its mass and it's been taken out and its size.
So then the thing you're calling the half-life radius is not the half-life radius of the galaxy.
Of the galaxy. It's of the disk. And this is the half-life radius of a pure spheroid, and this is a pure disk.
In some sense, this is comparison of apples to oranges, because you're comparing the entire galaxy to red points, and only the disk component for you.
Yeah, but that's because these galaxies are pure spheroids. There are pure disks here as well.
You can fit decompositions to those galaxies as well, and also you can decide, okay, I'm going to look only at the outer component.
Yes, we have, and what I'm saying is, and you can look at the galaxies that are essentially pure disks and pure ellipticals, and they have this same offset here.
This is much easier from the physics point of view, right?
But again, so I think it's meaningful comparison if you look at disks to say what is the half-life radius of the entire stellar component, and what is this half-life radius of just disks, just the relative. I'm not sure what do we gain by comparing the pure disk and disk galaxies and pure spheroids, like where you take in red points you take the entire light of the galaxy, whereas in blue points you take only part of the light. You decided I'm going to compare only that component.
Because it makes the point, Andre, that any composite galaxy that consists of a superposition of...
But there's no composite galaxy. It's a composite galaxy for blue points is quite close to red points, right? Right. So that's the null.
Right.
So then if you compare the galaxy to galaxy in terms of half-life radius, then it's a fair comparison. But if you just separate the disk, I think the disk can be compared to the disk galaxies themselves, to the total light. That's a meaningful comparison. That tells you how much effect the bulge has on the size of the...
Well, I'm just telling you that if we subdivide this sample, which is already small, and make it smaller by throwing away all the intermediate types, and keep only the things that have essentially no disk or very little disk, and no spheroid or very little spheroid, so that we don't have to throw away anything, they lie along similar lines here. The disks alone lie along the same, the disks alone of composite galaxies lie along the same relations as the disk, as the entire galaxies of disk-dominated galaxies. Okay?
But may I ask kind of a question? Yeah. So you throw the boundary component. But if you measure the size of the boundary component, which will throw away, whether these points will lie on the extension of the...
They lie between the two, yeah.
Don't have much smaller...
Only the boundary itself.
Actually, I found that the boundary is very small. So this is a constraint because...
The boundary will not lie on the mass isolation of the vehicle.
No, whether it's if you extend this, no. The smaller masses, and those boundaries are the small masses, right?
Okay, no.
They do join.
Depend on the type, this is very common, depend on what you call bound. They're classical bound, pseudo bound, whatever. But basically, if you just say the central component you get from decomposition and plot all of them, they will not lie perfectly on the extension of the relation for the program.
That's not perfect.
The slope will be shallower.
Yeah. Well, all of these slopes change as you go down lower as well. But there's an approximate extension. We checked that for this particular sample. So there may be slight offsets, but it's approximately true. Okay. So let me move on then. We also have the rotation velocities of these galaxies, and the mean rotation velocities, and that's plotted here now on this axis versus the stellar mass. And here you see the disks, and they sit on a very nice relation. That's the the well-known Kelly-Fisher relation. The spheroids are kind of all over the place. But if you multiply the sizes in this diagram times the rotation velocities in this diagram, which are kind of a mess, you end up with and put in the appropriate coefficients, then you have a measure of the angular momentum per unit mass of the galaxies as a function of their components, I should say, versus the stellar mass. And here's where the disks are, and here's where the spheroids are. One of the reasons I think it's important to pull out the spheroids and the disk and look at them separately, first of all, is because all galaxies are made up approximately of the sum of the two, but also probably the physics for how they form are going to be different. And so it's important to try and understand separately the properties of the disks and the spheroids.
The boundaries are taken out here as well.
These are just the disks, yeah. But again, I emphasize that if we look at the very late type spiral galaxies, the ones that have very little disk of their own, they lie right in here as well.
So this is isolated as well, but actually if I try to take out the bulk even for latest time galaxies, it still has the same function of size. It means that taking out the similar component actually is not true that it's small.
Okay, well, we found it wasn't this sample. So, a long time ago, the sizes of galaxies came up in the context of the idea that maybe ellipticals formed by merging spiral galaxies together. And the argument was that you couldn't take two, it was accepted then that disks were larger than elliptical galaxies of the same stellar mass or the same luminosity. That's essentially the result we're recovering here that's been around for a long time. But the issue came up is if you took these large disks and rammed them together, could you ever make anything that looked like an elliptical galaxy? That was a proposal that was on the table. And one of the objections to it was that if you did that, you would not make a very concentrated, high-density elliptical galaxy. You would make something that was more tenuous than real elliptical galaxies. And the way to see that is just that if two galaxies merge from a bound orbit, and the orbit is much bigger than the galaxies themselves, then the orbital energy, then the product of the galaxy that you make is going to have a binding energy per unit mass, which is the sum. I mean, the binding energy is going to be the sum of the internal binding energies plus the orbital binding energy. And the orbital part is very small, so essentially if you merge things together, the binding energy per unit mass should stay the same. And so you could take the same data that we've been using here to calculate angular momenta and sizes and other things, and just calculate the internal energies of the galaxies. And so that's what's done here. So what we've done here, this is the internal kinetic energy divided by the mass of the galaxy, plotted against its mass. And here you can see, this is a sort of more physical way. I think, you know, the issue of how you compare objects of different sizes, I think, comes up. And as I said, there's inevitably some subjectivity about that. But certainly one way you could look at this question is to ask whether the objects, a more physics-y way of looking at things perhaps, is to ask whether which of these objects is sort of more tightly bound than the others. Now what's done here is you know, we know the kinetic energy and the rotation of the disk, and that's plotted here, and then we know the velocity dispersion and the profiles and so forth for the elliptical. So that's what's done here, and there isn't a huge separation, but I guess you'd have to say that the ellipticals, at least in this sample, appear to be somewhat more bound, maybe a factor of 2 in energy, compared to the disks. So the disks are less tightly bound. So this would be, it's not a huge factor difference between the two, but this would support the old idea that the disks were less tightly bound than elliptical galaxies per unit mass, and so that if you ran them together, it would be hard to take some of these and put them into one of these and keep the velocity dispersion the same. But it's close enough that it's maybe you could make that work. In the case of the potential energy, which is more closely related to the size of the galaxies, you can try to do a similar sort of thing, but now you get into this issue about there's a sort of intrinsic ambiguity in how you calculate. You ignore the dark matter halo, you can calculate the potential energy in the galaxies, and I'll show you the results of making that assumption, but I just want to say beforehand that in the case of the potential energy, you know, for a composite system, there's sort of no completely unambiguous way to assign energy to one component or the other. So this may have been an argument that was legitimate before dark halos were known, or if you think the galaxies are mainly self-gravitating, then maybe you're allowed to do this. So this is calculating the potential energy of the disks and the spheroids as if they were the only object around. So it's basically m squared divided by r times a coefficient, which is, you can calculate for a disk and you can calculate for a spheroid, and when you put all that together, this is what you get. And now you do see a big difference. I don't quite know how to interpret this, though, because some of this may be the result of the fact that the ellipticals may be more self-gravitating than the disks, because the disks are somewhat more extended. I had hoped that this would give a sort of a clear distinction, or at least a clearer answer to this question of how do you assign sizes in some physically meaningful way. That didn't turn out to be a very clear answer. And now I think I'm going to, yes. And this is a thing, do you mind if I show this, Andrea? Okay, thank you. So Andrea and I have been discussing this, the whole issue about whether, you know, he was finding that the sizes of early type and late type galaxies were about the same at the same stellar mass. That's what he presented at the conference. And so I urged him to, you know, is it possible to, you know, split your galaxies into the spheroid and the disk components the way Aaron and I have been doing with our smaller sample, to see if they gave agreement. And so this morning when I opened my mailbox, this was in it. Thanks to Andre sending it to me I calculated this last night. And here he's done the same thing that I showed you on the earlier diagram for our sample, which is to plot the 3D half light radius, calculated I think in the same way that we did, and for the disks alone, I'm not exactly sure where he got the decompositions from, but anyway. Taking the spheroids out, throwing them away in the case of the of the disk galaxies and comparing only the spheroids down here. And again, you see this sort of factor of two offset that we saw with the smaller but maybe more accurately measured sample that I showed you earlier. So I would say, you know, I was certainly puzzled when Andrew gave his talk at the conference a few weeks ago and was wondering whether something like this was involved. And so, you know, we're getting closer to understanding this issue, I think. And my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, but my guess is that the sample as a whole, in fact, would lie between the two. And
sample as a whole is shown as a white line.
It's a white line, which is more or less between, well, okay.
So what exactly did you do to get the blue and the dashed blue lines out, right?
This photometry, this version of photometry has, it's a two-component decomposition, so surcharge and exponential. So the dashed line is rotating the half-life radius to the exponential.
But the stellar mass for the exponential component or the total at the mass for the stellar mass for the exponential component or for the total stellar mass?
So the stellar mass is plotted for the total as a total mass, but the size is only for the...
Well, as Mike, I think he was plotting the component mass, right? So it's not quite the same.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so you can do the same. I didn't do it here, but you can plot. There is photometry for just disks, so that will shift the radius to the left.
Well, that will actually increase the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
right now the difference factor of 2 Michael's talking about difference factor 2 to 3, so it would be.
So I think we're there basically.
Well, but to me the issue is, so I understand that the disk would be larger. To me the surprise was that the total galaxy was so small. Right? Because previous measurements which people did not separate it in distant boundaries, they were way far apart, like from under there, right? So the disk is larger than the galaxy as a whole. I think that's not. What puzzles me is that, for example, I would expect that the bulk distribution would go down at smaller masses, so this difference should go down. But it doesn't. It actually seems to be pretty constant. I don't understand why it's constant.
Wait, the difference between the red and the blue?
No, the difference between solid and dashed. So supposedly this is bulk distribution, but we are looking at dwarf galaxies. I thought they had more bulges. I don't understand why this effect is still right there. So it seems maybe some weird thing going on with decomposition, one thing playing off the other. I don't know.
You're using different mass to light ratios for the spheroids and the disks.
Mass to light ratio for each galaxy is computed individually using the color of the galaxy.
But the color of the bulb and the color of the disk separately, the way we are, or
here, no. But to get stellar, this is total stellar mass. You use total color.
Right, but. If you wanted to separate the disk out entirely, could you do that? I mean, do you have the color of that component?
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to try it, to make this full separation. I think you actually find a little bit more separation.
Yes, this is all can be done, but again, for me, the puzzle was the solid lines. Why is it so close? So the disk galaxies as a whole have the same. Despite the fact that the forms seem to be forming, if I have very different structure in the whole, half-life radius that is quite close to the difference.
Yeah, I went back and looked at the Shen et al. Paper, Sloan paper from 2003, and they don't think it's very similarly. They just used the half-life radius from the Sloan photometry as the radius and the stellar mass for the masses, and then split them into types just by concentration index or by Cercik index. So it's very similar to what you're doing. And it's kind of similar. The main difference there was that they seem to see a different slope for the early and late types. So they actually crossed each other at the high mass end, but they were getting somewhat different values for the lower mass objects. But the differences were not huge. I in memory, they were bigger than the one I actually looked at the paper.
I found that Shen's paper actually, because of background issue, for the massive vertical galaxy,
it's a very massive galaxy.
The slope is actually shallower than the real one. So the real actually.
So that would actually increase the separation again, I think, at the massive end.
So I mean, I don't know if you were at the beginning, but this is what we get for this sample of 100 galaxies that we studied. And you do see a little bit of a convergence here in this diagram.
Well, I probably can answer it. So one thing that I see is that the split of concentration and split of surcharge is not the same as split on the whole. So they give those things give different results.
Well, the Shen et al., they had they had the Sloan concentrations, which was R80 over R50, and the Sirsigan, which these are the two things they split on.
Right, but both of them, if you split individually on either one of them, they're not the same as splitting on morphology.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, qualitatively, maybe they give similar results, but not in detail.
Sorry, a naive question. Simulations, I would imagine that can tell you something about this, even very basic dynamic simulation on the contribution of a batch.
Well, let's try to get to physics. So Mike started talking about binding, but I don't know if this group could just progress the discussion. So this is plotting the, this is just to show you how much effect the definition has. So this is plotting now not separating disk and ball, just total light. And what you see, this is for gamma galaxies for reasons that I, for Sloan leaf, essentially, we get very similar result, just that for gamma, I have sizes measured along the major axes. And the ones that I can circularize for the Sloan photometry, I can only circularize with the eyes. I can show the effect of what circularization has on the size, on the half-life radius, on the gamma circuit. So this is...
There are 2D radii available for Sloan, if you care.
I'm sure they're available, I just don't have them on my disk.
I mean, the gamma photometry, the Sloan photometry.
Well, but for all of Sloan?
Yeah, no, they're available, I just didn't have them easily.
I
don't want to use them, so I only use them for tests, so I don't care about that. So I think the answer is really. So this is the half-life radii for galaxies split by Sirchak index, but I followed Mike's advice and split on down the middle, but they gave it both the gaps. It's galaxies with Sirchak below 2 and above 3. This is the disks, dash line, and this is spheroidals, and you get the factor of whatever, 2, 3, significant difference. If you circularize this radii, yeah, just take into account that the Mike said the square root of A to B is going to you get the solid lines. Yeah, so you get solid lines, and these are the same galaxies, right? So clearly solid lines are closer together, right, than dashed lines. And the only thing you're doing is you're comparing circularized profiles to profiles on the major axis, and the difference for major axis definition is maximized because spheroidals are spherical, like they're much more circular, whereas disks are elongated, and so you're just comparing, apples to oranges if you're using this definition. So that's, I think this is a big, huge part of the reason why people were seeing at higher edges, if you look at Van der Waal, why they're seeing a large difference between disk and spheroid, because you use major axes for the definition. So the circular.
So for disks, sorry, I mean the solid curve does what? I mean, so for disks, which is seeing edge on, what would the answer be?
I'm actually not sure what is the answer, but for edge on, you also suffer from the projection effects for disk.
If you take a disk and you put an edge on, then you get smaller radii, right?
So it becomes much more concentrated.
Circularized.
So your blue, so the solid curve, so smaller than the dash curve, mainly just due to the distribution of the viewing angles? Is that what that means?
This is just observational, right? It's not tilting any viewing angles here.
Yeah, well, So essentially, the way I think about it, this is not corrected for inclination, right? So you're just measuring the light, and you're measuring the distance along the major axis of the light distribution, where you include half of the light.
So when you circularize, you're including the minor axis, which is an inclination effect for the most part.
Inclination effect.
Disk axis.
For disks. Because if they're face on. A and B are the same.
That's right, but they're not face-on, right? So I'm trying to make them face-on by circularization, essentially. at least
the linear axis would, you know, I mean, like, the linear axis would be the phase on view, right?
Well, this may be, but if you actually fit a 2D profile, so I'm not doing these fits, but when I use a catalog from the Leonardis group, which fits 2D profiles, but then immediately you know, translates into circularized radius, these are the lines you get. If you overplot there, half-life radii, they are very consistent with the solids.
But if you just take this edge on disk and take the circularized radius, that's not the same.
No, that's not
the major axis. Why would you not just take the major axis layer?
Yeah, I understand why you want to circularize.
So for the same galaxy, if you put it face on or edge on, do you get the same radius or do you get different?
No, so the circularization means that you actually are tilting, you know, you're essentially correcting for inclination of the disk and you're measuring the circular radius in viewed perpendicular.
Are you actually deprojecting or are you just taking?
Yes.
You are deprojecting this.
Yes.
No, but here is just the circularized means you just correct based on the access ratio of the circuit model. That will, the more the disk is edge on, the basically you underestimate the size of using the circularized radius.
Why do
you
underestimate?
Because you fit one circuit model to the edge on galaxy, you get a very small access ratio and result in very large correction, which is not physical deprojection. This, at least in this catalog, the circularized means you just square root of the x-ray.
Sure, but here's what you get from the if you just use the same slope. So this is the thin lines here, the same from gamma, where this is circularized procedure, and this is what you get from the linear catalog. And there, they don't do that. They don't correct for B over A. They fit the 2D model.
No, the 2D model gives you the major axis.
The way they fit it is, maybe it's not too technical in discussion, but the way they fit a 2D model.
Yes.
But the surface density profile that they fit is circularly symmetric. That's what they do.
They plot it as the function of the
They project this.
This is Bernardi group. Yes. I think they're just using Galfi, which just fit an elliptical 2D model. Which the effective radii is guy. I'm pretty sure they also use access ratio.
They fit a 2D profile in the plane of the sky, but the radius that they derive is the radius of a spherically symmetric profile.
Yeah, but in practice, they.
But how does the radius they derive relate to the two axes on the sky? Is it just a geometric mean?
I don't know. It's just that what's followed here is what they provide in their catalog. But the thin lines, is the radius.
I think the two standard conventions are you either plot, give the major axis value, or you give the geometric mean and the major minor axis value. Probably can find papers that do both. So calling it circularized is probably the second one.
Yes.
Well, maybe I'm using very conceited, but they derive a radius that corresponds to a symmetric surface density profile. So if surface density you would plot as a function of R, where you don't care about the
But you could plot one which is either you could plot one with which the scale was the major axis or the minor axis. The question is how you do conversion, right? They're both.
So effectively, the way I understand what they do, they fit a axially symmetric profile to a projected image, but they tilt it in such a way that they fit the observed A and B profile.
But then the half-life radius that they get must be the same as the major.
But it's not. I just showed you. So this you know the solid lines that you see here, the thin solid lines, are the same as dashed lines here. So it's the same as solid lines here. Maybe the scale is plotted differently. So this is dashed what you get from along the major axis from the gamma catalog. This is if you correct them by a view ratio. And these solid lines are the same solid lines in this plot. And this is what you get from Bernardi's.
I still don't understand. Because Bernardi's paper, I'm 15, that's basically MERT, that's Bernardi's paper. Yeah. I qu- quite certain that their paper using this basically the same software and similar strategy with the gamma people. They do more fancy model. They do Circe plus exponential is the workflow proximity. But if you're using the Circe model here, basically they're exactly the same with gamma.
Oh, they're the same after I correct the gamma major axis by
See, that's the part I don't understand.
Well, but that's, I mean, this is my data. It's just doing simple iteration. If you want, you can sit down.
Right, but you might be misinterpreting the data.
In what way?
I think that from the Bernardi group, the circularized effective radius is the same. Basically, I'm not surprised that if you plot the circularized with the circularized, they're exactly the same.
So the solid line from Bernardi, I'm just putting whatever is in the calculator.
I'm trying to argue is I think those two lines are consistent with each other because they are derived in the exactly same way. They're from 2D single circuit elliptical but symmetric model.
The thin lines are uncorrected on the gamma.
Yes, because gamma didn't do that, but a Bernardi group provided the corrected one. Basically, Bernardi group already done the work for you.
Okay. We should ask ourselves why.
Yeah, but
why are you looking at circularized? Why would anyone want circularized radii? I think there's an answer.
I blame the
oblate or prolate. It's not clear that the major axis is what you want, but if you're thinking about a disk, in our minds it's infinitely thin, then a circularized metric that somehow takes into account the fact that there's inclination doesn't make as much physical sense.
But if you have a disk and you tilt it, and the obscuration is radially independent, because there's obscuration issues as well, then the half-light radius face on is same as the half-light radius along the major axis in projection. So that would argue for taking the major axis profile.
Right.
If you want
I think people who use circularized radii are used to working with elliptical galaxies. I think that's where it comes from.
From the size evolution for elliptical galaxy. Yeah. Yes, and I think this is the high Z people started doing.
The community that uses disks wouldn't necessarily want to use.
They will never use this. Okay.
One other comment I will make is that the Circic profile is not necessarily a great measure of the disk and bulge properties of the galaxy, right? I mean, this is why I think if you do have actual decomposition, so you can compare the components separately. I think that's a cleaner thing to do.
The components separately, you're not comparing galaxy sizes. You're comparing sizes of components of galaxies.
Right, but you're comparing components that formed in different ways, so it is interesting.
It's interesting, but it's not the same as comparing sizes of galaxies.
No, but I would argue that Circic function has intrinsic problem, which is a strong degeneracy between the effective radii. I mean, we'll actually do the fitting, the effective radii and the Circic index. So I'm not surprised that I had a high mass and the two, the basically low Circic and high Circic, they start to. It's hard to. Basically, a high mass, and if you tell me there's a disk galaxy and a blue galaxy have the same size, it doesn't really tell you much information about their structure. If you're looking at an image, they're very different galaxies.
Images are very different. That's why I found that the size, if it's no matter sizes, is positive because the appearance is very different.
Yes.
So, you know, the fact that they're different is not a surprise. We know that, right? What's surprising that the half life radii is similar.
Maybe what you're saying is this is a coincidence, it's just a property of this particular definition of the radius.
Because some of them can never be.
And I should say that if you think that Circic profile has three parameters, like one is normalization and Circic, and if those parameters degenerate, if you start fitting multiple components, the parameters of those two components are highly degenerate as well. If you just introduce more parameters into the problem, if your profiles are not good enough to constrain three parameters, well.
But I guess at least for the nearby galaxy, I would argue that we have pretty physical evidence that there are multiple components. So using single source, basically you ignore this.
There are multiple components. I'm just saying that if you see degeneracy for a simple function, that you'll see degeneracy when you introduce multiple components, because you're just introducing more parameters into the problem.
Depend. So that's because I guess we don't know what is the perfect function for like bulk. For disk, a lot of people use just exponential profile.
It's just a historical. If you look at the actual surface density profiles of disks, they're all over the place. I mean, they are roughly on average, they may be approximated by exponential or some range of scales. Yes. If you actually look at the wide range of scales for well-studied disks that contains galaxies, they are barely exponential. They actually look like surgic indices in profiles on the outskirts.
It's
life scattered. So if forcing an exponential, you think it's a good thing to do, but actually it's not.
So one of the cleanest things you can do is you can compare galaxies that have little or no disk with galaxies that have little or no bulge, and you'll get the same results that I mean, when we do that, we get the same results. And that's a very clean thing you can do. I mean, that doesn't depend on Cirsic or anything. That just depends on you being, I mean, or experts like Hubble or Sandage or the Vocalure being able to tell you whether there's a disk in an elliptical galaxy or a spheroid in a spiral galaxy. And if you just take extremes and put their sizes on those diagrams, you see railroad tracks separated by factors of 2 or 3. That's the cleanest thing you can do in this game, in my opinion.
Well, they weren't very good at it, right? I mean, one of the results from Atlas 3D is that for all ellipticals less than about 10 to the 11 solar masses, they think there's a disk component.
Well, there's a disk, but if it's 10%, who cares? It doesn't matter.
Well, it's tens of percent.
For disk galaxy, you also think bulge is 10%, who cares? But you take it out and the size changes dramatically. So for ellipticals, you're not actually... In principle, there's evidence now that you should be fitting multiple components to ellipticals as well, and then separating the outer component the same way you do for the disks, right? And you're not doing that. So I think when you're comparing these two ellipticals, it's not really a fair comparison. Otherwise, we'd have to also analyze the components of elliptical galaxies and make this component separation there as well. If you're comparing total light of galaxies in disk and spheroid, that's fair, right? You're just including all light. But once you start separating components, and this, I think, has to be done self-consistently in galaxies of different types. So when you call them pure bulges, pure spheroids in these galaxies, it's been shown that every single elliptical has an outer component that's consistent with exponential disk for nearby galaxies. And that's not taken out, right?
No, but it's measured, and so we can plot the ones where that's not dominant. And plot that versus the
bulges of late type galaxies are also not dominant, and yet they have significant effect on size. Somehow. I don't understand why they have this effect, but it's circles. I want to have some time for the discussion of this plot that you ever want to discuss.
Okay, well, I can just say a few words about it. If we move the different components of galaxies that look at sizes, they're also surprises. This is a relation between type relation. This is the total mass in H1. What's new here is this is a compilation from work by Wang, who went to the archive and just pulled across essentially every galaxy with a interferometric map that she could get hold of and put them all together. So this is 562 galaxies from 15 interferometric data sets. And this is covering a huge range of different kinds of galaxies. So it includes, amazingly, galaxies and clusters. So this, in addition to normal spirals that you know, this survey VIVA, these are these 36 galaxies, are from the Virgo cluster, and that's Jacqueline von Borken's data set, where she talks about H1 deficiency and Rand pressure stripping, and some of them have. And it includes Malin up here, and it includes this dwarf set, the little things and the big, so the, all the dwarfs are down here. And I'm just, I don't have anything to say other than this is one of the tightest relations I know. So the scatter in here is a 0.06 dex in the diameter here. Now, initially, when we first had this relation, we came up with some semi-analytic models to where we assumed that gas accreted with exponential profiles and did some atomic to molecular transition stuff and could get it roughly right for normal spirals. But I don't understand, you know, why this should be followed by dwarfs with no increase in scatter, apparently, or by cluster galaxies or by early type galaxies. Yeah, there's this Atlas 3D, that's an early type galaxy sample, so that's and that's also on the relation. So I don't know if anybody
I just noticed it looks like that's a line of constant column density. It looks like you have 6 orders of magnitude on the X and 3 on the Y. So that size going like the 1/2 power of the mass, that's constant column density. You said that things were measured down to a given column density. Is that a coincidence? I mean, that's the kind of thing that where you have to worry about selection effects on surface parameters, right? That's a constant surface density line, constant column density.
Yeah.
And you have sensitivity down to a certain column density.
Okay, so some of them go deeper. So, so the typical column, so she cut at columns of 10 to the 20, which is, but we have data that goes deeper, which doesn't deviate. And you can go to, you know, a few times, basically most of the observations for 12 hours you cut up at a few times 10 to the 19.
Well, do you know where the surface, you said that these profiles were measured down to a certain column density. Where is that column density? It'll be parallel to that line.
Okay, so the,
sit on that line.
Yeah, so the profiles, I can't speak for the dwarfs because I didn't see the profiles, but for the normal ellipticals, the H1 profiles go roughly like this with a bend. So you can, they're fit with two exponentials. There's an inner exponential, and then there's an outer exponential, and the column density limit is on the outer exponential. So this relation, so long as you're roughly on the outer exponential, you get a tight relation. Well, you start deviating once you get into the bend, which we think is caused by conversion to molecular gas.
I'm asking a slightly different question. The profiles are probably measured down to like 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 19.
Yeah.
Those are typical. Where is 10 to the 19? Per square centimeter on that diagram.
What do you mean where it is?
It's a line.
It's a line on that plot.
It's a line parallel to your data points on that diagram.
So 1 kiloparsec.
One, yeah.
I mean, 10 kiloparsecs.
In other words, if it's down here or down here, it's not a selection effect. But if it's near here, then you have to worry that there's a selection effect.
It's only a little below. Not a lot below. I mean, they're all measured below that, otherwise they couldn't determine the size and
frequency. So that'll give you some of the scatter.
But so how high do the column densities get? They don't get much above 10 to the 22, do they?
No, 10 to the 22 is where you go molecular. So,
I think, I mean, part of the fact is that the total accessible range is not that big. You have to be more than 10 to the 19, otherwise it doesn't count.
Yeah.
And you have to be less than 10 to the 22 because then you're all molecular. So you only have the range in between.
Yeah, that's
not for the average value.
That's true, but that would
be large.
Well, that's still, yeah, still big. That's still 300.
Well, then you take the square root of the
scatter here, 0.06 decks, 0.07 decks.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, three orders of magnitude is the whole vertical axis there. So, it's
no, still here. It's 1.5 orders of magnitude.
Yes, sir. Oh, correct. Yes.
But if it was just a surface density effect, it would be a huge scatter.
No, if 1.5, it's factor 30 max.
No, it's scatter, the fixed mass. Exactly. If it was just surface density, it's a huge scatter.
Well, this,
this
range.
I mean, that's part of it. It means that the profiles all have to be very regular.
Yeah. So if you look at the paper, their interpretation is that profiles are universal. Yeah. And they don't reference Blitz and Bigel to show that they are universal.
Oh, there's a British paper that does look at that. So,
but they don't reference the newspaper. So, okay. You know, they interpret this relation as a signature of universal profile, which I think that's what it shows, but they don't reference the actual paper.
Yeah. So the question is, why is it universal even down here? Or even in...
Well, I mean, the why question, I think, is interesting, but Bigel and Blitz show that it works down to dwarf galaxies.
No, they actually, that universal profile was just for the things Heracles, so that's
here.
In this range. They didn't do the dwarf galaxies.
Okay. Well, they went down to OC, I think, right? Which is dwarf. But
yeah, but not, this is only, this is.
This alpha alpha here?
Alpha alpha is single beam. So this is, mainly the compilation of everything they could find in the VLA.
How do you distinguish galaxies with different magnetic, especially for the dwarf region?
I don't know this paper. I don't know if they did. They don't talk about that, do they?
Why would you distinguish? Why would you metallicity?
Because here I'm thinking about why the reason for the profile being self-similar is because the star for me, or molecular, atomic molecular conversion happens at a certain surface density. And there is a cutoff. And that cutoff sensitively depends on metallicity.
Well, that hasn't been shown that convincingly observationally, I think. There's some signatures that that's happening, but not.
Yeah, theoretically.
It's theoretically predictive.
Yeah, because this very tight relation, I think it is reproduced in one version of my model. Last year when you visited Carnegie, we talked about that. So that's because I just put in that a surface density threshold for molecular formation. So because that's something I put into the model, then I reproduced it. I'm not sure whether the metallicity dependent molecular formation will distinguish.
So that's mainly, I mean, the molecular composition is about over here. It's column of about 10^21, 22. That's when the molecular. So this size is measured pretty much outside by. So it's a you're down in column by. 100.
Glenberg, if you were to plot this diagram here looks much straighter than the one between the sizes of the stellar components of the galaxy. So that I think that's interesting in itself, right? Andre showed the relation is sort of, it levels out, and what's interesting is that these two don't track each other.
No, they don't track each other. So, this. Interestingly, not much relation between the two. So
is the stellar mass or the half-life size compared to this gas size, is that, does it get larger for smaller galaxies? The ratio of those two?
I haven't seen it for this plot. They don't actually have the stellar sizes in there, but they tend to scatter. So if you just plot stellar size against H1 size, and for galaxies that span a range in, did they have the action of it?
Here comes the next one.
Okay.
I anticipated this question. So here, this is actually things and little things.
All right, okay.
For the meanings. And so the relation is actually close to linear. It's not exactly linear, but it's like 1.16 power or something.
It's stars on this and gas on that?
Yes. And this is Kraft mass.
Yeah. And gas is H1?
These are dwarf galaxies. So they're actually colored by mass.
that exactly how, but this is really obvious.
You said this is things and little things.
Things and little things.
Yes, I think there'll be less scattered here than there would be in the other plot, because the other plot has things like the Atlas 3D galaxies and the Virgo cluster galaxies, where the gas is actually quite small compared to the scale.
Right, but little things were on the previous floor.
It does look one-to-one.
Okay. Well, no, I understand. They had basically everything on this plot.
Yes, little things are where the magenta is here. And the same that for these guys, at least with magenta guys, it's not that different.
But the ones which should scatter off this relation.
I'd be surprised if Atlas 3D, which is in pink, I can't see pink.
Yeah. I can't
see pink, but those tend to be large ellipticals in the H1 surface. Okay. But in any case, I think it's interesting to think about in conjunction with stellar sizes, because this is just supposed to be the fuel that's going to turn into stars now, or at least capable of it, whereas the stellar sizes are the integral over all the size evolution history of the halo and of the galaxy. So.
Right, so this suggests that the H1 profiles are very similar, right? So if DH1 is proportional to Vito radius,
yeah.
That, I think, is what you're going to get.
Does that say something about feedback? The halos that host the galaxies, and the feedback processes somehow equilibrating somehow to make this?
Well, wait, I don't understand. This relation is a line of constant projected density, whereas the halo size should come from a constant volume density arrangement, right? I don't think you would get this slow if the H1 size is proportional to the size of the halo.
That was Andre's relation, right?
What's that?
That was Andre's relation. It's not clear why it happens, but it does seem to happen.
Yeah, there's no way.
It wouldn't happen
exactly
because it's the wrong slope.
There's no curvature in this plane.
Yeah.
So DH1 cannot just be proportional to Vito radius.
It doesn't need to be curvature here because there's no stars in here. But what I'm saying is that the halos that you're comparing with, if they're all measured at the same epoch, then they're all going to have the same 200 times the background density. So that will be a relation of n. Or the size going like the one-third power of m instead of the one-half power of m, right?
But in your little things plot, that was basically proportion, right? The stellar size.
Well, it's slightly superlinear, but I was surprised that it's losing more than it's.
And are these are the rays containing half of the H1?
Yes. Actually, sorry, this is includes molecular gas, it's not quite the same. So this is including both molecular gas and H1. This one can be done just for H1.
Yeah.
The size of the other,
that would explain that. Yeah.
Suppose
so the molecular traces the size there.
Right, although for a small galaxy, it's a small fraction, so here I wouldn't expect it to be.
Yeah.
Right, we have 5 minutes till cookies. What's the most interesting question?
Explain all of
it. Explain.
Well, we didn't discuss what it means in terms of physical models.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe. We can discuss everything in one discussion probably, but
is there any sign of a conflict with the current generations of simulations? I mean, for example, the Eagle people claimed to have fit the size of galaxies as part of the tuning of the model. But I suspect they didn't fit over not such a big range as you're talking about.
And even over the small range they fit, the scatter was significantly larger.
It was bigger. Scatter is one surprising thing. So even just at the fixed stellar mass, the scatter and sizes is, because it includes all the observational errors and all the errors of conversion of light to stellar mass. And yet it's more or less what you expect from the just spin distribution, right? And or even somewhat smaller. And that's kind of strange. And I think this is related to the tightness of Terry Fisher or Fabian Jackson. I think they're just very tight. And so it may be that feedback somehow affects the scatter, which is a way that you can understand.
The other thing we saw in Eagle is what I expected to see in this paper, the Eagle comparison before this paper came out, is the scatter blowing up at the low mass end, where the feedback became more.
And also, what we know is that without feedback, you can't get them, right? Without feedback, you just don't get
them. You get the wrong size.
And so size is somehow evolving in conjunction with total stellar mass, total gas mass, and which is controlled by feedback. But if we know that the feedback is not included and the disks or gas become self-radiating, then the sizes go haywire and they don't. The galaxies become unstable and the sizes grow small, you develop these inner concentrations. And to keep that from happening, feedback is essential. The old problems, right, that we discussed in galaxy formation, the overcooling problem and so on, but that was manifesting as sizes being too small.
I think wasn't what Harry Desmond was showing us was a lot of the size and the size distributions of what you predict from the angular momentum. Even in the simulations he was looking at, was it Illustris or Eagle? I've forgotten which one.
Eagle.
But in Eagle, even though the sizes were what was expected, when you actually looked at the correlation between the halo angular momentum and the disk angular momentum, there wasn't any.
That's right.
So it looked as if, but it didn't work in detail.
For the stars, for the stars,
that's right.
But one thing is that the two angular momenta, they don't have to, they shouldn't be measured at the same time.
That's true.
Yeah, and he did show that there was a better correlation if you looked at the angular momentum near the center. Somebody did. Maybe it was the Eagle people themselves.
Alison, did you want to comment?
I'm looking up because I know, I think the Nihao people have looked at this. Nihao. Yeah. So they would not have done the more massive galaxies. But I know.
Are you talking about H1?
Yeah, in H1 size relation paper. I can't remember if it was Greg Svensson or Aaron Dutton who was the first author of that. So
yeah, I think it was a paper.
But it's consistent with the observation.
But I think they looked at dwarfs as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.